Thundergrunt.
Hey guys.
Hey Bob.
Hey Bob.
Hey, welcome to Writer's Blockbusters, the show that treats the final edit of a movie like it's the screenplay.
That's right.
It's so like Kevin Smith the way you say it.
I know,
comic book man or
something. Well, how am I supposed to say it? Go around the table, introduce yourselves. What's your Twitter handle?
I am Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and full-time script consultant. And my Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
I am Jamie Nash, screenwriter, and my Twitter handle is at Jamie_Nash. Quick plug, I think by this time my book Nomad, which is kind of a horror sci-fi thing, will be an audiobook on Audible. So go buy it, I think by this time. Also, just if you really love me, if you really love me and you've never done Audible and you never plan to do Audible, if you do it for the first time and you choose my book, I think I get like some bounty money, like $50 or something.
Oh.
So if you never want to do Audible, just go do me a solid and go buy it, and I'll get $50 and I'll spend it on food.
That's awesome.
Spend
there
it
you
on
go.
Food.
It's some weird thing. I am Bob Rose. My Twitter handle is at Thundergrunt Bob, and I'm going to try to convince Jamie to buy me lunch once he gets that hot money.
Absolutely. if I get a bounty.
Right.
This is episode 50, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, happy 50th anniversary, 50. Guys.
Just peaked the audio there.
Probably. We made it to 50, and yeah. For 50, we chose, I think, the movie, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A movie we've all talked about doing.
Yeah.
A movie that with a script that I think both of you have said you use as like, like here's a monument for your students to look at.
Yes.
You know, here's where you look.
Yes.
Back
I'm
to the future.
Constantly sending clients to various moments of this movie. Absolutely.
Yeah. This is
using it as examples, top to bottom.
Back to the future.
Back to the future.
Right. Written by...
Oh, it's not Back to the Future 2? I watched the wrong movie. No.
Well, just try to keep up with us. Anyway, who wrote Back to the Future, Jamie? Not that we don't know.
Back to the Future 2? No.
I think it's the same writers, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
They brought on David Goyer, I think.
Oh,
Jesus.
So I don't know why.
God damn.
No offense to David Goyer.
No, some, actually.
So, Back to the Future was written by Robert Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale.
Both the Bobs.
Both the Bobs.
Yeah.
And this movie, I'm scrolling down to IMDb because I'm thinking it was coming off of, I mean, there's a long development history with this movie. Mm-hmm. I think they wrote it early, like after Used Cars, like somewhere around that time frame.
A great movie.
There you go.
I love Used Cars.
Still
another one I use
it.
As a model in some ways, just because.
Are you serious?
In a different way, more conceptually.
I use
a lot of it's Used Cars with blank. You know, I remember my early screenwriting
career. Your students
career.
Can't know what Used Cars is.
I don't use it to them.
Oh, okay.
But back in the,
I was going to say.
It's more the old screenwriters like me. But there was a time when I was constantly trying to make my own Used Cars, but it would be something else, you know.
Yeah. I've never seen it.
Yeah, you should probably watch Used Cars because it's like. Got that. It's like that's almost 70, late 70s stunt movie esque, but it's an 80s movie with Robert Zemeckis and Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell.
Anyway, go ahead.
Two competing used car lots, basically.
Nice.
It's a sleazy movie. Okay. Yeah. Sleazy, yeah.
So, anyway, Used Cars, they were coming off of that. They wrote the screenplay. I don't think anybody was. I think it had money that somebody was developing at Columbia or something.
Nobody wanted it.
Nobody really wanted to make it. But then. Robert Zemeckis did Romancing the Stone, another one of my favorite movies.
And I feel like we should do that at some point.
I think we're definitely going to get to that at some point.
In another movie that I use, I was always trying to rip off and find my own Romancing the Stone. I've never tried to rip off Back to the Future as much, but I probably have an execution. So Back to the Future was bouncing around. I think he was friends with Spielberg, who produced Used Cars. But I don't think Spielberg wanted to be attached after Used Cars or something.
Interesting.
And then,
that's not his style. That movie's really sleazy. It's like almost a Police Academy type movie.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And I don't think it did very well. I think it was
it didn't. No.
So ultimately, I knew there was a whole thing, and there are many drafts, and we'll talk about some of those. Ultimately, I think there was a whole thing I read about where they did a trade with Universal. Columbia Pictures, they had the rights to Back to the Future. Universal wanted to make it. Sid Sheinberg or whatever the guy's Sheinberg,
you're right. Yeah. Sheinberg.
He wanted to make it. He liked the script. And there was a Double Indemnity rights issue. Like Columbia wanted to make a remake of Double Indemnity called Big Trouble. And it was some kind of trade they did. They did a deal. And that's how Back to the Future ended up at Universal. I think this is something I read a long time ago. I'd have to look it back up. And there's
I've read all this. You're right.
There's a making of book for Back to the Future that I read
a couple years ago. Lot of this is on the Blu-ray extras too.
Okay. Yeah. Which is, I'm sure, where they get this stuff.
Right.
Anyway, so this is kind of the history of it. So it eventually got greenlit. I remember also, didn't they want to call it, they had an alternative title. I think it was like, the alternative title was actually Spacemen from Pluto. Like, that's what they were trying to force.
Because it was supposed to be named after George's book.
His book. Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that was,
So, and they were like, Back to the Future, that title's horrible. Let's go with Spacemen from Pluto. Right. That was the studio kind of enforcing
it.
Anyway, these are the things I remember. Let's get the box office.
Yeah.
I mean, and also, I mean, production-wise, the big one is that they shot for 6 weeks. With Eric Stoltz.
Oh, yeah.
And then they reshot it.
And it wasn't funny.
Right. He didn't. So. Yeah. As Zemeckis has always said, that footage will never be released because then people would use it as to say he was bad at acting. It's not Eric Stoltz's fault.
Yeah.
He was miscast.
At this point, Eric Stoltz could suffer the blow.
I bet he'd be cool with it. I think he would.
That's what I'm saying. He's had a fine career.
Although maybe it is a hurtful memory.
Maybe.
You know?
Yeah.
But everybody's seen the pictures. We all know. That's what we
Zemeckis wanted a comedy. So he got a guy from a sitcom instead of that a guy that was crying all the time. Yeah.
So 1985, this movie came out. It was the number one movie in 1985 domestically.
We knew that.
$190 million.
Wow. In 85.
So here are some
That's a hit today.
Wow.
Here are some of the movies that just missed beating. Actually, they came kind of far away. Beverly Hills Cop.
Okay.
Was number two at $157 million. Rambo, First Blood Part Two. Was at $150 million.
Jeez.
Wow. Rocky IV was at $89 million. A good year for
Stallone.
Wow.
He was almost in Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Tune into our Cobra episode.
All right.
Okay.
Should I do a Cobra episode?
Cocoon at $76 million. I think one of my friends told me he was kind of bummed out because we're getting to be the same age as Wilford Brimley in Cocoon. It's like, wait a minute, what the hell's going on? I'm still a few years earlier.
Well, how old was he in Cocoon?
I think he was in his early 50s.
Okay.
In that. So I'm getting close to Wilford Brimley in Cocoon age.
Look how it turned out for him.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then Witness at $68 million. Goonies at $61
million. What a
year. Another one we'll have to do one day.
Oh, my gosh.
Police Academy 2 at $55 million.
My favorite Police Academy.
Fletch at $50 million at number nine, which I would have never thought that was number nine.
Do Fletch at one point,
yeah.
And A View to a Kill at $50 million at number 10. They're your top 10 movies.
I like
1985.
How whenever we do an 80s movie and you read off of the top 10, we're always like, what a year! But really, we're all just saying we're old and we remember all these things fondly. That's what we're saying.
I guess we've read. Last year, it's what a year to somebody, but you know.
Well, I'm saying that you could read any 80s top 10, and I'd be like, yes. You know what I mean? That's going to be me.
That's true.
Right.
But it's kind of like to think that all those movies you saw in the same summer or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Together.
It's kind of amazing.
The quality level and the originality.
Yeah. It was a busy summer. I saw a lot of movies. That's
but this is Back to the Future was the biggest.
Yeah.
Yep. And it made $388 million worldwide.
A hit today.
Yeah. In 85.
That's a big movie today. Wow. And this is counting
unless
inflation?
It's Solo, and then it's
But Solo spent how much money?
Yeah.
$388 million.
Did it actually cost $300 million?
I think it probably cost close with the reshoots. It's undisclosed, but I think the reshoots drove it. It almost doubled the budget.
More than Speed 2.
Speed 2. Yeah, listen to our Speed 1 and 2 episode if you haven't for that hilarious tidbit. All right, let's jump in.
Yes.
Let's talk about the instructive lock-in.
Yeah,
Back to the Future.
Jamie, you want to describe the lock-in and we'll
bounce
off of it?
So the lock-in is one of my key simple concepts because you don't need a whole book to really understand it.
Mm-hmm.
You can just If you want to know story structure, this is kind of one of the things. So when we talk about log lines, and we've repeated this a few times, but I'll go over it again super quick. Log lines typically have a few, there are a few things that all log lines should have. They have a hero or a protagonist, I guess, with a goal. There's an obstacle in the way of that goal. And then there's some stakes that if they don't get the goal, some horrible thing will happen. You know, the world will end, whatever. So the lock-in tends to be a spot. It's kind of the point of no return in your story where all those things kind of cinch into place.
Yep.
So it's kind of like Marty McFly. He has to get back to the future or he will be stuck in time. So we're saving the stakes of his family being erased for later.
Yeah.
Because that's the raising of the stakes, but just the initial stakes of the movie. Marty McFly has to get back to the future or, you know, he'll be stuck in the past. The obstacle is, you know, time travel.
All the various things.
All the various things. And when that gets locked into place, what happened, would you say?
That is 31 minutes. So
31 minutes.
And we've talked about on the show.
What's
also
the perfect
is
lock-in time, Jimmy?
In all the books, you know, that have their positives and negatives.
Right.
You know, there's this stigma that things that the end of Act One, the lock-in, has to happen 25% through your story, and lots of writers are really like paranoid about making it happen.
Can't
exactly
be page 24.
Exactly.
Has to be page 25.
They literally will be like, if it happens on page 26 of my 100-page screenplay, I'm fucked. You know, I mean, people really get upset about this.
They take
and
the
get
creativity
concerned
out of stuff, huh?
Right.
Yeah.
And so, what we have when we've been examining these various lock-ins in this movie, we're finding time and time again that is not true. That there's one. We're listing one great movie after another where the lock-in is later than 25%.
Doing Rocky eventually.
Yes, which is a 50-minute lock-in.
Yeah.
This one is when he goes back to 1955, it's 31 minutes, which is 28% of the overall story. So there you go. See, it's a little later, but who cares? It earns all that before world setup. You have to set up so many things, everything's a setup in the first act of this movie. So
yeah, and I when I'm analyzing stories, usually that's like the first thing. I figure out where the lock-in is. And then I retroactively figure out some stuff based on that, like where the act breaks are
right,
and what things are. If it's slow burn, like some horror movies and stuff might not have a true lock-in to page 50. So lock-ins are really instructive to me when I'm kind of analyzing a script.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone listening at home, what's the lock-in in Back to the Future?
When he goes back to the
past.
That's
what you guys are talking about specifically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because then
I knew that. I'm just
then
saying.
Then the
like,
overall,
you know, say it.
I always look for what clarifies and clearly defines the overall central story question.
Kind of a point of no return, right?
Oftentimes it's described that way.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it's a new world. They're
right.
In a new
the
world.
Upside down world.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not always, but most of the time.
Yeah, not
and
always.
What's funny about the goals in these two is a lot of times they are the title.
Yeah.
You know, the goal
back
is the
to
title.
The future, right?
Back to the future.
Back.
I mean, even something like
you're saying in the lock-in.
The Wizard of Oz is kind of what her goal is.
Yeah, that is funny.
Yeah.
But there can a lot of times it is the title.
Yeah. And one of the things that
when they first bust ghosts.
Hey.
Hey.
Yeah.
But what there's two things that this can be used as sort of like a gauge for. A lot of times I'll run into scripts that don't have enough setup and they rush in to the lock-in like 15 minutes in, and then you start learning things about their character and like the things that need fixing and various things after they're locked into the story problem, and it doesn't land the way it should because we're more focused on other things. Or the other thing, and Jamie, you've talked about this I think with your students, mm-hmm. you have this lock-in that doesn't happen until like midway through, the lock into the overall story problem happens way later than it should. So it's sort of like we're not
at
invested.
85 minutes.
It's like the movie. The reason that we came to see the movie doesn't begin until halfway through.
Just to give you a point, like imagine if this movie, if the lock in didn't happen to minute 60, and you didn't know what it was about.
Right.
So a lot of times with the new
it would be like a high school movie.
Yeah, you're like, what is this movie?
Yeah, what is it about?
Why am I watching?
Right.
What's going to happen? And
right.
then all of a sudden this time travel thing happens on page 60.
On page 60, we see a time machine.
Sure, at some point, you're from Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We really should. Yeah. For, yeah, for that kind of
because
thing.
It blends, it plays
does
with
that.
Those
yeah.
things. Yep.
Yeah.
Successfully.
Right.
But yeah, so, you know, it's this is
it's
the prototypical lock-in. Will Marty get back to the future?
And it's, I mean, ideal it's at 30 minutes, 25, 30 minutes. It's,
that helps.
Right.
But
right.
it doesn't have to be that.
There's some argument that people say it's oftentimes when the character makes a decision.
Right.
In this movie, it's kind of, I guess, his
when he
decision.
Makes a mistake.
Yeah. It often yeah. is that. I don't know that's always when a character makes a decision.
So
sometimes
I'm saying
forced
in this, it's in this a mistake.
One. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. In this one, well, he's just trying to get away.
Yeah.
So he has to.
Yeah. You know, and yeah. he doesn't realize for sure that he's. There's another 10 minutes before he realizes the problem he has to solve. But to yeah. me, I think our superior position works so that we know the
yeah.
story problem he has to fix is
like,
will
well,
he get back?
It's not just superior. I mean, Doc shows that it works.
Right.
We already know it
and
works.
And that's a pivotal moment
right.
in that. The
Einstein
scene
Einstein.
Is
yeah, yeah.
The Einstein moment is crucial
right.
to give us context because otherwise we'd be like, well, what's, is it working? Is it going to work? Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned the 10 things that need fixing. Should we go
the
into that
the
now?
Yeah, yeah the six things
sure.
that fix.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll jump.
Six things.
We'll jump
yeah.
around.
Explain
yeah.
also what that means.
Okay. So yeah.
Because there are things we're trying
so,
to fix
so,
back
okay,
in the future.
Okay, this is taken directly from Blake so, Snyder's
yeah,
Save the Cat.
This is a Save the Cat notion.
Which book?
It's the first book.
The first book.
Not the best one,
well,
the third one.
Yeah, that's right.
But this is a movie that follows Save the Cat to a T. I mean,
right,
it's
right.
worth talking about.
Well, okay. I'll get to one point that I always
oh,
worry about. Yeah.
Nice. I can't
okay.
wait.
Yeah.
But so there's basically Blake poses that in prototypical, in like arc plot movies, A first act of a movie will be used to set up all the things that need fixing in the world of the character that is going to be explored for the rest of the second and third act.
Tell people what an arc plot movie is.
Ooh.
Oh, arc plot is just meant like your classic structure movie. Heroes have goals, obstacles, and stakes. Things are setups and payoffs. They're mostly just by way of example. They're most of the movies you see. So Pixar movies, superhero movies.
We call them cheeseburgers. On
if, cheeseburgers.
If you're yeah. if you're making an experimental film, you know, the Lynches of the world. This is it, that, these things don't
apply.
Right, don't apply. Right, yeah. If that's what your
or,
goal
or
is
more Sundance,
as a writer,
a more Sundance movie that
this doesn't apply to you
feels like real life might be a yeah. little different. It might take pieces of it, but not use all of it.
Right. But audience expectations.
We're talking about blockbusters, and that's
right.
usually what an arc plot is.
That's but right. audience expectations yeah. based on these types of movies. Do the stories need to do these
they're
things?
They're kind of closed loops.
Right,
yeah.
closed loops. So these are the loops they're creating.
That's right.
All the things that need fixing. And they typically fall into five categories. Changes in attractiveness or personality. Strained personal relationships. Not being trusted with responsibility or not able to handle responsibility. Being invisible to key people. Others don't believe in you or you've given up on yourself. And the reason that I wanted to bring this up is because that doesn't describe Marty. That describes George. So
yep.
it's very interesting in those things, the things that need fixing are technically George's problems, basically. Marty's world around him has many things that need fixing.
Well, that
but
brings
it's
us
all,
to the next point,
yeah.
right?
Which makes this an interesting movie because, like you said, to the next point, George has the big arc, and the arc is almost Marty's goal for most of the movie.
To make another character's change.
George.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think the only other movie that I really see where the arc is this integrated into the plot, or one of the movies, it's not the only one, is Groundhog Day is very much that
mm-hmm.
way. Because it kind of becomes the arc, almost is the plot. It's the goal. If he changes, he can get out.
Yep.
But in this movie, it's really interesting.
He's got to change yeah. another person. Actually, almost two people, but... He has to
yeah.
change another person to get free of the underworld.
So,
whatever,
so the one
right?
thing I was going to say, it's debatable whether Marty has an arc or not. He doesn't have much of one, but so here's the evidence to Marty's arc. He goes to that audition. He goes to the audition,
yeah.
and he comes out, and he won't send his tape in. He can't take rejection well.
Yeah.
And I think the theme that they keep hitting is, you can do anything you want if you put your mind to it,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. But he seems like He's a slacker. They call him a slacker, but you don't
but
really
you don't
get to
see
feel.
The slacking.
You don't feel the slacker.
Yeah.
He feels pretty active, actually.
I know.
He feels pretty active. He doesn't really feel like a slacker.
Yeah, I agree.
So you don't really buy it that he's a slacker.
Yeah.
And he's pretty.
Because he's awesome.
He's pretty awesome and well-rounded.
So I assume we're arguing from a point of most people that analyze this movie think he doesn't have an arc.
Right.
That's what I've heard most. I know. Jimmy.
I'm going to hit back.
You're going to hit back. And let me hit back first if I had to. Tell me if this is an arc or not, but I always assume that his faith in his family and his father was his arc.
Yes. That's what I'm saying.
Like, he doesn't...
Well, not the phrased that way.
Sorry. Yeah.
On
his
the
respect
same
and faith. His respect.
Yeah.
So like, he doesn't have... Like, the beginning of the movie, he does not respect his father.
The one exercise...
Exactly.
Yes. The one exercise I always say, you know, to do is, if we took the Marty from the end of the movie and put him in the beginning of the movie, would he be different?
I think so.
I think he'd have more
confidence.
I think
he would stand up to Biff in the very moment that he watches Biff and does nothing.
Yeah. Then he has an arc. It's obvious that his father does, but does Marty? Is he different in the end that if we just took his character
I think
and
it's
put him
a
in,
great exercise.
Would he?
I was
going
to ask you, Jamie, to do this.
Okay. No, it's small, but it's there.
I think on the one side of it, the arc of awesome, the agent of change for everyone else, the Forrest Gump, the Benjamin Button, is very apparent. He's changing everybody, you know, in his actions.
Being Marty.
Marty is changing everybody by his very every action.
Yeah.
But I agree with it's weird. Both of you are saying the exact same thing that I'm saying, but I'm just going to say it differently.
Well, Jimmy, even though we're saying that, it still feels like external. You know what I mean? Like,
it's internal.
Feeling wise, though, it doesn't feel like Marty changes
so,
that much,
here's
except
my
for
evidence.
The respect for his father.
That,
that's
and
about
that's
it.
Okay. Yeah. That's enough.
That's
it's
enough.
Learns
yeah.
to. There's one of the arcs is learns to accept others' faults and flaws.
Okay,
which is sort of a respect thing, and that includes Marty's own, where he's like no longer feels like he's worthy of rejection. Like when he plays on the, he earns that playing in front of everyone. I'm never gonna get to play in front of everybody. In the beginning, he thinks his dad's a joke. It's very clear. He's ashamed of him. He's embarrassed by him. And then he gets context to his life, and he realizes, I'm very much like him. Like, and then he learns about his ambitions to be a sci-fi writer, and that's like this moment. Like, he's an artist, and he's just like me.
I didn't know you wrote anything.
I didn't know you're an artist, and you're scared that people reject you. That's just like me. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I think it's as simple as he learns to respect his father. Yeah. I think it's I think it's enough.
Also, they don't show it, but like Marty has his own bully, which is Principal Strickland.
Yeah, right? That's true. That's true. That's a good point.
And he sees his father has his own bully. So yeah.
So the draft, the 1984 draft, not the 1980 draft, which we might hit a little bit earlier. The 1984 draft, and this is the thing I went to look up, had more of an arc for Marty. It's the same script. It has the DeLorean and all that stuff. It's pretty similar. It has a couple more beats that I almost wonder they may have been shot. And they're small.
With Eric Stoltz.
They're small, yeah.
Right.
So
we don't have any more money to reshoot.
There's a scene where he has like a tape he's going to send to the record company, and he stuffs it in a drawer or throws it in the trash or something before all the stuff happens. And then in the end, he pulls that tape out and he mails it.
Wow.
So it actually shows he learned confidence or whatever. It's a little...
That's informative.
Yeah.
That's really
why
significant.
Why do you think they cut it?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a little on the nose. Maybe they just realized they didn't need it.
They didn't need to give you the feeling that he's changed, that everything's
like
better.
2 minutes of stuff they could just cut out.
Yeah. Makes it faster.
Yep.
As soon as you're done, get out as fast as possible.
Right.
Don't stick around. Yeah.
It's a little on the nose. It's not like something we would have been like, oh, we're
amazing.
So, we feel better.
Because it's almost like the performance at the concert being a success for saving his life. His music literally saved his life is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's like we don't need that. Yeah. It almost feels like a down step from the concert saving his life.
Right.
Like, what's this tape gonna do?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, wow, that's good.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
I know a lot about Back to the Future. I didn't know.
Yeah,
that.
Some of the stuff I'm gonna bring up about the old scripts is gonna be like, what?
No, I mean, I know most of that.
Bob's like, shit.
I don't know all the words to describe everything, so you guys win anyway.
So I think we're all on the same page.
To some degree, I think it's still light. I think that
it's light. I think it's light.
I think that
Marty, George is the one.
You know, like I told you guys, I think the most famous person I've ever heard talk about this not involved was Dan Harmon, where he was just like, it's amazing.
That's a good person to hear talk about
right.
this movie.
It's a good person to hear. And he was like, it's amazing that, you know, to write a perfect movie with a main character who has no arc. So he was just straight up, Marty has no arc.
He was saying,
straight up.
So okay.
I found that interesting.
The interesting thing about the respect aspect, too, if you look at the origins of the script that I kind of skipped over, is I can't remember if it was Gale or Zemeckis, but they were looking at a yearbook of their father in the attic, and they saw that he was class president, and they never knew that or something.
Wow.
And then they wondered if they would be friends with him or hate, because he hated the class president
in
his school.
That's the whiteboard right there, right?
Yeah. So they saw that, and that was the inspiration. The inspiration was more like, would I have been friends with my parents if I was their age back in the day?
Wow.
So that gets to the arc of
respect.
So
it's sort of like whether they were trying to or not, it's there.
That was the genesis.
Because
the
seed was there.
Seed of the idea to do this movie.
Side note, it's also
pretty
funny.
That's awesome, Jamie. I didn't know that.
It's funny that like that's the origins of this movie, but I feel like in pop culture, it's always the sci-fi aspect of these movies that are...
Of course.
You know what I mean? But really,
it's... But the beating heart, that's why it's...
What is Back to the Future about? It's about meeting your parents in high school and seeing what they're like.
Seeing that...
That's what the movie's about.
Giving you emotional context to why they are the
way they
are.
Right.
The one thing, I mean, this... kind of goes away from the screenwriting side, but I remember when I saw this movie, it was weird. It was a weird movie because I was used to the sci-fi, you know, the big boom, you know, effect.
Right.
This had a little touch of that.
Yeah.
But then once it was in place, it was a movie about a guy in the 1950s. So my parents
liked it.
Fish
out of water.
Fish out of water. And it was more relationship. And I did get the fact that, you know, his mom's saying Calvin Klein, you know, and checking his underwear out and stuff. Like, I got that as a, you know, little kid or whatever when I was watching it. My parents liked it. My sisters liked it. You know, everybody got it. It was this true four quadrant experience.
Yeah, also, it was like Zemeckis said, it was the perfect time to make the movie, because if you go that far back for that kid's parents, you're at the one time period in American history where kids started to have their own culture.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was like the perfect moment to make this movie. Nope. Like lightning in a bottle.
The joke is, if we made it now, it'd be 1990.
90, right. Yeah. And like 1990, I don't see the same like impact that the 50s
had. Well, the world was so much, the contrast in the world. But then then the story
shows. But imagine the 40s from the 50s. That's so different, you know? Like, that's like a turning
point.
But
I love that the contrast, that once Marty digs in, the world is actually very similar. And the problems are all the same. You know what I mean? We're shown, it's all happy and everything. And it like seems like this dreamland.
Well,
and then
also,
it becomes very
real. It's a
writing
thing to say that this movie is tongue-in-cheek to some degree.
It
absolutely.
Is.
Mm-hmm. I think the whole trilogy is tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
That's the
point
of it.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's
a
not straight.
Stylized world.
There's a tone argument in there somewhere.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah,
we didn't put it on the talking, but you're right.
Like, things constantly happen all the time in different eras. Like, that's the point. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, so Marty's arc, we're all kind of in agreement.
Yeah.
George's arc is pretty easy to define.
Yeah. I wanted to talk less about his arc and more about the execution of his arc.
Yes,
so,
please.
So, first of all, so the theme, are we saying it's if you put your mind to it, you can accomplish anything?
So something I think about putting yourself out there. Is that
my question to you guys? Because I don't have the answer. I'm just asking.
I don't know if that's actually the theme.
Yeah, it seems like standing up for yourself and doing what's right in the face of people doing what's wrong is a huge. That's what George does to succeed.
It's kind of an overcoming your fears aspect.
Yeah,
in some ways,
standing up for yourself.
It
seems like standing up for yourself is a big repeating thing in the movie.
There also seems to be something else there that I'm trying to figure out. I never really thought about the theme of Back to the Future.
Well, the one thing is, here's the one that I think would be instructive to tie in. Like, all those things make sense for Marty. They make sense for the father. What's the thing that makes sense for Doc Brown?
That's exactly what I was going to
say.
Yeah.
You know,
what's the one
Doc's
that loops
theme?
Him in, too?
Doc and Marty's theme.
Well, the line that's repeated by Jennifer to Marty and Marty to George is Doc's line. They got it from Doc, which was, if you can put your mind, your mind to it, you can accomplish anything. That's Doc's mantra. And then other people are talking about that.
But I feel like the Doc and Marty, there's two movies almost.
Yeah.
The Doc and Marty movie is about friendship.
But then ultimately
it's not about respect.
He says, what the hell, in the end. He chooses to read the letter, and that's what saves his life. Right. So what does that say?
There's a part of me that's like, what if and again, I didn't do
stand
this
up
work,
for yourself.
So we're kind of doing this.
I kind of figured I'd do this on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah, I was doing this
that's
on
what
the
I was
fly.
Waiting
so,
for, yeah.
What's the position Doc Brown is in when Marty visits him in the past?
He's Where a joke.
He? He's a joke.
He's a loser. Yeah.
What's his internal feeling? Sorry to
that
walk
his
you through this.
That his no, this is great. No,
yeah, I'm trying
his,
to figure it out.
That his inventions aren't going to amount to anything.
And
that
how
all
does,
of his purpose, he has no purpose. He even tells Marty, "You've given my life direction. You've given my life purpose. I'm going to miss you."
Marty's like his savior.
Yeah.
How does he do that? Does he just tell him he's going to do these great things in the future so then he has faith? Or is it something
else?
Well,
he tells
else?
Him it works.
It
tells
worked.
Him it works.
You're,
yeah.
I invent something that finally, you know, yeah. Like, yeah, he learns that he's actually going to do it.
But, that, yeah. but so I always look at the success of the characters and the action they take, and that tells me a lot. Mm-hmm. And the action that he takes, that's the moment of growth for Doc, is that he chooses to go against his own advice and read the letter because Marty says your life depends on it. So what does that say?
This has something to, yeah, this has something to do
the
with
reading,
like...
Reading the letter is his action that saves him. Mm-hmm. That's his success moment for Doc. And that's the moment of change because
like,
he says, hell, what the hell? That's like
well,
his,
so,
yeah.
So
like,
here's
what,
where I
okay,
think
go ahead,
it's...
Go ahead.
You can change your future kind of thing.
Yes.
You can be
You
the,
control your destiny.
You control
so
your
it's
destiny.
The Back
not,
to the Future 3 lesson?
I don't
what you
know
make
it well enough to but
yeah.
I
make
do,
it a good one.
The future yeah. is not set.
The future is not set.
It's what
you
make
can,
of it.
You can make your future.
Yes.
So you,
he basically says
so
that at 3.
You can do whatever you want.
Which is an extension of if yeah. you put your mind
put your
to
mind
it, you can accomplish anything.
You can
yeah.
accomplish anything.
Yeah. So
there's
yeah.
something
there's
in
something
that,
there.
In that mix.
I knew we weren't going to land on anything because it's not overt. So
I feel like there's a friendship one in there somehow.
I'm enjoying this.
I feel like there's a friendship one.
Yeah.
I feel
so,
like there's something in there else.
My only reason why I don't know about the friendship, and I do think there's a strong friendship in many movies.
There's such an emotional core at the end.
I'm not sure that they learn that here. It's yeah. just in existence. You know, that's why.
Well, what you
they,
said, though,
well,
that
Doc,
the future
Doc
is
learns.
Not set and you control your destiny. Mm-hmm. I mean, even like George's line, I am your density. Destiny, that yeah. seems to be like he can't even get that right. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Doc, think, but... In the movie we watched, Doc becomes friends with Marty. Marty's already in love.
It's true.
Loves him already.
That's true.
Right?
I don't That's
know.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know. Like, it almost seems to me like Doc learns there's something more than his success with his inventions.
Mm. Okay.
You get what I'm saying? Like, yeah. there's that's why he says, well, fuck it. There's something more important than science and, like, numbers and... Like, you're not supposed to do this, but I'm going to because I want to live. And I want to see...
My future, my
I
life.
I want to see Marty again. Yeah. I love yeah. Marty. He's my buddy.
Yeah.
Like, there's something there. I don't know how to put it in the words.
Like standing up for yourself.
Sure, that's kind yeah. of, but yeah, in the face of oblivion, I guess.
Destiny.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I would argue their destiny is the main antagonist of this movie, trying to knock them all down.
Trying to knock, yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
It's like a Final Destination movie.
Yeah, dude, absolutely. yes, it is.
Yeah, right. That's, okay, that's so my, how does yeah. that play into George's arc?
Okay, so basically, what I wanted to talk about with George's arc is this. We're constantly hearing in you know the writing circle about checking the story boxes versus cinematically earning the moments, right? Usually the reason that something feels like a check the story box instead of an earn moment is because we don't get the in between. We get the setup and we get the payoff and we don't get the growing pains in between. And this movie is an excellent teaching example of showing, visualizing the growth, the spurts and the regression. George has, I'll give examples. Okay, first George's in action at the cafeteria when Biff is harassing Lorraine, which is like sort of a, you know, a setup for the eventual payoff in the end.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Marty confronts him at his house. And it like is like adamant, almost like shaking him, like do it. And he says, "I'm not ready." So that's a second beat of growing pains. Third one is when he actually tries, and he says, "I am your density." Mm-hmm. then Marty and George are actually practicing, get your damn hands off of her. And he says, you make it look so easy. And he tells him how scared he is. So we're seeing another growing pains. George stares at the clock and it almost feels like George isn't going to do it. Like when he's drinking like by the punch bowl and he's freaking out. It's like you almost feel like he's not going to do it because he's so scared. And then even when George confronts Biff and tells her to leave him alone, Biff overpowers him. So we get another moment of failure, another moment of trying and failing. And it isn't until he finally knocks him out. That's how many beats. And then we get more. We get a regression. After that big climactic moment with Biff, some guy comes in and takes Lorraine away. And he's like, okay. And so I just wanted to say that those are 8 moments of growing pains. And usually what you'll get is maybe one. Imagine if you only had one of those moments. It wouldn't feel like.
Punching Biff and the beginning of the movie.
Between the beginning and him punching Biff, if you only got one of those moments, it wouldn't have the emotional resonance that it does. And it's just a great example of visualizing the change from beginning to ending of a character is basically what I was trying to say.
Also, this movie has that rare opportunity because of time travel to show that not only is he like this at the beginning of the movie, but this guy never... We already know going in superior position, right?
Right.
He never got better. Like, no. He's this guy. His life.
So it's more dire.
It's dire. Yeah. Right? Yeah. We know like this you is not the... just now. This is always.
Yeah. George's arc is like one of my favorite arcs of any movie. It's like the one I point to. So it's odd that he's not the main character. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Just because we don't follow him doesn't mean he's not the main character.
No, right? I get what you're saying. Yeah. Oh, it's one of those Red versus Andy Dufresne things?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, right. Okay, midpoints.
Yeah, midpoints. So this is one of the like classic midpoints in some ways. So where I hit the midpoint for this movie is when Marty goes to Doc and he finally convinces him, you know, of everything. And he's like, we don't have any plutonium here. And then he, you know, flips the back of the page and it's a lightning bolt. So it's a victory of sorts.
Yes. Right. False victory. Yeah.
Almost right next to that is when they find out that he's interacted with his family and that's making
it's
his family.
It's the same scene.
It's the same scene.
Yeah.
So you get, it's kind of the good news, bad news.
Mm-hmm.
I know the Blake Snyder books will say a false victory. This doesn't feel like a false victory because the victory is still there. It's just there's good news, but there's bad news. It works the same way.
Stakes raised.
It's the domino effect in the scene.
It resets the goal.
Yep.
So like before the goal was bigger, and now it's like no. First, you got to do this other thing that your existence depends on it.
Right.
Your very existence.
So midpoint's a good place if you need to reset a goal. It's a good place to do it, and it's also a good place to start a ticking clock.
Yeah, and that's where first see the photo. That's where we first see the photo disappearing. The in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like one of the I can't think of another one, a time travel movie to start a ticking clock that is so viable. It's really hard for time travel movies to do that, and this one found a way early in our time travel movie life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because that lightning bolt, because they only will ever know one lightning bolt when it's coming. That's it.
10:04 p.m.
Right, right.
Yeah. It gives a specific and...
It's such a hard thing to accomplish.
I know. It doesn't feel contrived at all.
It doesn't, and it's so well done, and it's just so rare. There's never a why can't they do this in this movie.
It's another one of these great things. Like they do the it's the thing I say about sitcom exposition, make it a joke.
Mm-hmm.
So he's about to kiss his girlfriend, and then somebody shakes the thing in their face and stops the kiss, and it's like fucked up. It's kind of a throwaway thing, but it's actually setting up this huge important thing that's gonna come into play.
It doesn't feel like we're being shoveled exposition. Exactly.
Not at all.
Yeah, that's
not
a good point. The joke. Yeah.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's midpoints. Is that?
That's midpoint.
Oh, I thought you saw more.
Yeah. Nah. That's good.
That's all you got.
Yeah.
Okay. Urgency. Visualizing.
I mean,
countdowns. That's kind of what we're talking
about.
What we just talking about.
I mean, I wanted to talk about how this movie doesn't. A movie about getting lightning to strike a giant clock, it doesn't rely on just clocks for its ticking clock mechanisms. It's a great example.
It's chock full of clocks, though.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I didn't. I didn't. It is chock. I mean, there's like 30 something.
It opens
in the
on
first
clocks.
Scene.
Yeah. Right.
Specifically, I just wanted to talk about the three visualizations. So, like, when you have a ticking clock, I just got done a set of notes.
Which is a term. We're talking the term ticking clock.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, this movie.
Okay. Basically, here's how.
There's a lot of ticking clocks in the opening.
Yeah.
Here's how.
Versus the, is it a Save the Cat ticking clock? Is that what it is?
Yeah, no, just, Save the Cat is not the, not where ticking clock
we mentioned
came
them, but
from.
Dude, there's, you guys got all these
I
books.
I know, we got the terms. It's just a general writing term. It's basically. You have
bomb under the table.
You have a deadline to achieve the goal. Here's what it is. A character, and these can be used from scene to scene. It doesn't have to be one long one. It can be one for like half a scene even. You have a goal, and then you have a deadline, and then you have to count down to how long a character has to achieve that goal. It's as simple as that. And if you do not visualize the countdown, we feel no urgency. That's what it is. And I read script after script after script. I'll just give an example of a script I was working on yesterday. Has a fantastic deadline, right? And the stakes are clear. It's basically like the fate of a country is at risk. And there's something happens with a deadline that's been defined months from the beginning of the movie. And we hear about that deadline on page 9, and we aren't reminded how much time has passed for 70-plus pages. So we feel nothing. We don't have any idea how much time is left for the character to achieve their goal. Right. In this one, we're getting like various visualizations of the countdown, like maybe like one every couple minutes. You know, I didn't track it. But like, and three of the examples of it doesn't have to be a clock is the disappearing photo, right? We're constantly shown the photo again and again, and people joke like, "Who carries a photo around with them?"
Oh, their family.
But people have it on their phones now. What's the big deal?
I'll never forget in the video game that it was a photo that was disappearing as you had to go through the level.
Jesus, that video game is so hard.
It's horrible. It's awful. But I just remember them using that device in a video game. This is the ticking clock.
That's good. Yeah. So the disappearing photo is one way. Like we're constantly revisiting that photo, and we know. That you know, when all the people on the photo disappear, the time is up, right?
Yeah.
And the second one is, you know, Marty's hand while he's playing. That's Marty's hand is a ticking clock mechanism.
This now
it's a way
now,
to visualize the countdown. Oh shit, he's missing his hand.
Yeah.
And then there's you can do it up too. So 88 miles per hour is a ticking clock mechanism. He's got to. It's a deadline of itself, and it's going up, and it's visual. Nothing needs to be said. So this is just a great example of how you don't need a clock to remind people that. Time is counting down to the deadline.
Even though this movie has a clock counting down
it
to
does.
The deadline.
A giant clock.
It actually has a clock counting down to when Marty needs to start the car and a giant clock counting down to the... it's there.
In a movie filled with clocks, the ticking clock mechanisms are not clocks.
Right.
Yes.
But they are some clocks.
There are some.
That's really the beauty of the lightning bolt, too, is that you only get one shot at it.
Yep.
So there's
tension.
One split second that they have to do it.
Yeah.
And he has something else he has to do that's life or death at the prom or whatever the date. So anyway.
But what's great is they tell us we have one, when we find out at the midpoint there, they say we have 1 week to do this. Mm-hmm. And then the story allows us to track as the days go by, as we get closer. And that's what's important. We need to be reminded. It's Monday now. It's Tuesday now. It's Wednesday. These things matter, and that's how you feel like, oh, shit, the pressure is mounting. And most of the scripts I read, this is like one of the most common things where we'll get a deadline and we won't be reminded of how much time has passed for like the whole script, or we'll get to the end and we'll learn that there was a deadline the whole time and everybody was acting about like urgent about it, but we never heard what that deadline was. So it was irrelevant. We're like, what's everybody rushing around for? There's something.
Yeah.
So,
and the setup really helps with this because it's not just the lightning bolt. We've got the lightning bolt and the dance.
Yeah.
And in the face of that, he's got the antagonist trying to ruin.
Right.
What he needs to do for the dance.
Which slows that shit down.
Slows that shit down as another ticking clock. Yeah. You know, it's like constant.
He gets put into the trunk. Yeah. These are various ways to
alter
the clock.
He's in a pressure cooker the whole time from the lock-in, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, and even in the beginning, it plays with time with the ticking clock mechanisms when all the clocks are wrong. And that's like a great example.
Yeah.
The clocks are set behind and he's 25 minutes later than he thought. So that's like a great example. The clock is wrong. Yeah.
Well, speaking of slowing shit down, I'm really happy that we talked about this beforehand. Let's talk about the villain. Because I was saying in our Joker episode, we started that with Jimmy's giant list of rooting influencers.
It's not as big of a boot.
No.
Book report.
You called it rooting influencers.
Okay, so yeah, I went to this. Do you want to keep going?
Well, no,
what
I was
saying?
Just saying, like, can we do. It's amazing that you made a list, because I was like, we should do an opposite list of rooting influencers for Biff.
Yeah.
Because they set him up, like, one after another of why.
Like,
this
instead
guy
of save the cat, kick the cat.
Yeah. Kick the cat.
Kick the cat.
It's that so much.
It's
yeah.
so
yeah.
perfect.
There
you go.
Kick, how to,
and that's
how
why
craft,
Jamie makes the big
yeah.
bucks.
There's, how to
there's
craft
movies
a villain,
that kick,
kick
the cat.
The cat.
Yeah. Kick the cat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even though I don't want to see cats getting
don't
kicked.
Kick a cat for real, please. Thank you.
But okay. So I went to I've
Jamie's not endorsing
this.
That.
Unless it's the movie Cats. Then you can kick
they
the
kick
cat.
It as much
oh
as you want.
Oh my god. So I've talked about this in other episodes, but for those of you who haven't heard them, the greatest seminar I ever went to, and it was a finite amount of time that this guy, and there's no
Tony
materials
Robbins.
Online. Tony Robbins changed my life, man.
Nothing to do with scripts, but I feel great.
He had a seminar called Beyond Structure, and in it, he's super protective of his material. So David S. Freeman, I'm quoting you here. You're
he's
awesome.
He's going to hunt you down.
I'm like so paranoid when I do this.
All the money we're making from this
yeah,
podcast.
Yeah, all the
Look
money
so
we're
mad.
Making. It's yeah. it's his ideas. He says that he has this list of rooting influencers. And these are things that we watch that you front load. You can keep them going for the whole movie, but you front load them. That's the main goal is you. As soon as we meet these characters, you pile these on so that we feel like empathy towards characters, and like we invest in them. And you can do the same thing with villains, except you can downtick them. Sometimes you can keep the uptick, like we talked about in Die Hard. He's got style. He's smart. These are the same things that make you root for heroes, but you give them to villains.
I mean, Marty has a few of these, right?
Marty has
yeah.
a shit ton
yeah,
of these.
A bunch of these.
I can make
right.
a. I'm sure there's 30 or 40.
A lot
40
of
them
are sympathy based, but.
Yeah.
yeah.
I'm sure you can right. pick 30 or 40 for Marty over the
right.
course of the story because
yeah.
they keep going.
Yeah.
But with Biff, it's all downticks. So, like. What I'm gonna do is describe the rooting influencer that's the positive, and we'll talk about how it's the negative.
Okay.
Okay. The character is an everyman or every woman or an underdog. Biff like thinks he's better than everyone, right?
He's also
like,
bigger than most
he's
people.
Bigger, mm-hmm. right. Physically he's, imposing.
He's
yeah,
imposing,
yeah.
Bigger.
That's a yeah. good one. A character is authentic and warm. I mean,
yeah, done. Right.
Dude,
right.
he couldn't be more heartless.
Yeah.
A character takes responsibility for their mistakes. I mean, the very first time we meet him, he scratched George's car and then says, "You blames it on George." Right. A character does a good deed for someone else. I mean, we see him doing morally wrong things over and over again.
To kids.
The kids is on
there. Oh,
here.
It's on there? Oh, okay.
Maternal or paternal towards kids. He's shitty to like all the kids that he encounters. That's a kick the cat thing, Jamie, right? Another character says something sympathetic about them. Everybody who's talking about Biff is talking about him like they hate him or they're
right,
scared
right.
of him.
Right.
The character is funny, witty, or clever. He's funny because he's not clever and
right.
thinks he is.
Right.
It's
actually like straight up specific.
Yes.
Like he can't even get like idioms right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It's just perfectly anti that.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
A character solves their own problems. We're constantly seeing him getting people to do things for him instead of him doing them himself.
He's got lackeys.
Yeah. So those are the ones. That's
yeah.
10.
Yeah, and what that does is it makes you root for this character to get a comeuppance.
Right.
Whereas in the other ones, we root for them to get their just rewards.
Right.
And this character, we want to see him fall on his face.
So
that's really what it does. It's a lot like wrestling, I think.
Yeah.
Like when you set up a heel character, you
yeah.
want to see them go down.
Right.
You don't
yeah,
want to see
yeah,
them
yeah,
win.
Yeah.
You want to see the good guy, the scrappy good guy win.
The
you
underdog.
Know?
Yep. Yeah. yeah. So I think this is like the fifth episode we've used them, and they just like fall right in line. They're always instructive, and they show, especially the Joker one. There's like 20 plus in the first 20 pages. So
I mean, there's also a lot of more specific ones too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
how he treats women, you know,
yeah,
like
yeah,
like all
yeah,
like
yeah.
Like really obvious stuff.
You mean Biff?
Biff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Biff, yeah.
yeah.
No, not Marty. Biff. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a really good one. I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, it just like feels like Biff is like in a movie like this to have a villain that's so defined of being just a piece of shit down the line on every check mark. It's just like perfect. All right, let's hyper skip. I'm just kidding, guys.
That's our new
phrase. Rise of Skywalker, hyper skip. The lightning experiment. George and Lorraine's kiss. Visualizing goals. We kind of covered that.
We've pretty covered it, but I just wanted this scene, the lightning experiment scene. Jamie originally thought I was talking about it, some mysterious screenwriting exercise.
Yeah, I was like, what's the lightning? We write a bunch of ideas on the board as fast as
possible.
Lightning exercise. Yeah. Shit, man.
That might actually work,
though.
That's
a great label.
Yeah, that might actually work.
No, but... and I want to get your comments on this, too. I don't want to just be barking. This is the scene, the lightning experiment scene, after the midpoint. That's why
With
the model.
The miniature.
Where you have the miniature,
right,
and you have the model of the car, and Doc
If we didn't say that, I would have been confused, too. I just want you to know,
I'm
Jamie.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And Doc shows, basically says, here is what the plan is, and here is how we're going to do it. And he sets the car down, and the lightning strikes, and the car goes on fire. That is, for me, just like the lock-in is prototypical. That, it, to me, is like the perfect visualization of the objectives at hand. And I always tell my clients...
And it shows the stakes because the car blows up.
Yeah, the car
catches on fire, right, yeah.
Because a lot of people complain like, well, I knew what the ending was going to be. And I my argument always is...
Who's complaining about Back to the Future?
No, I'm saying like in situations like this, like... there's a place for telegraphing.
Yeah.
You want to show, bless you.
Because it's tight.
You want to show people what the end looks like. The craft comes in making surprises for the duration to the path getting there. Right. Right? And this movie, like, imagine if you didn't see that. If that model scene isn't there, you're like confused about that last scene.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a 5-point finale thing.
Yeah.
There's the one thing where they suit up in the beginning, the gathering of the team. And I think of, like, when you were talking about it, Star Wars, the first Star Wars, A New Hope,
mm-hmm.
When they're saying the Death Star is here,
it's
and here's
exactly
the model
that.
And this and that.
Yeah.
And yes, spoiler alert, the Death Star blows up in the end.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make it a lesser movie because it was predicted in the
visualization of the goal.
Yeah, it's how we get there. In fact, it gives tension because we see all the things
exactly.
they have to do to get there. And then when they start going wrong, we know that they're going wrong. Otherwise, we wouldn't know they're going wrong.
Exactly.
We don't know
how do you know it's going wrong if you don't aren't shown what victory
but
looks like?
But there are
like.
Movies that don't follow this.
And they work.
Yeah.
Sure. I think Ghostbusters doesn't really follow that rule.
No,
yeah,
they
not
just
at
climb
all.
To the top.
Yeah. They don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going
on.
We just go with
it. I think there's value if you're telling an arc plot story.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what genre it is. It can be like a
I'm
family
not trying to
drama.
Discount. I'm not
it can be a comedy.
Yeah.
No, you're right. I mean, it's not.
It's not. Yeah. This isn't the rule or anything.
Yeah, yeah,
I'm just saying it's a very helpful and instructive thing. Like to ask yourself, what is my version of this scene? And is it in my script? Am I clarifying for the audience what victory looks like and how victory they're going to try to achieve it?
Yeah.
Like you said, Jamie, that's perfectly put. Like, how do we know it's going wrong if we aren't shown what it's supposed to look like to get it right?
I have an affinity for these scenes. I love models, but I usually have, like, in my screenplays, it's Legos or toys
right.
or cardboard boxes.
Yeah.
I tend to write these
I feel
scenes
like,
a lot.
Deadpool did this.
There's a million, examples of
Deadpool
this.
Deadpool 2 did a meta version of this.
Ah.
Where they showed the map and, you know. Like,
Yeah. But, and we have seen that scene over, but, like, your job is to make it fresh. I mean, you still can do it and make it fresh.
Right.
Which is the meta version of it. But and the kiss is another example of just like clean, easy storytelling. Like that's another major goal for Marty. And like, how do you visualize like the kiss? That's all we need to see. Nothing needs to be said. He doesn't even need to say, I need to get them to kiss.
Yeah.
Like we know, like it's romance. It's like if we see them kiss. And this is like another example where like I'll have clients who are like explaining away the kiss. Like, I need to get this relationship to reach this thing and blah, 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 blah. And instead, they just need to come up with something that is the peak of that shows us.
Right.
And nothing needs to be said to make it hokey.
Would this count as visualizing goals, the picture? Because
the picture is another goal. Absolutely. Well,
I'm saying
restoring the family.
Yeah, like the picture saying, here's what's happening. And
absolutely.
What you obviously want is this picture
nothing
to be
needs
restored,
to be said.
Right?
I mean, it's so clean. Nothing
so
needs
clean.
To be said.
It's just like once
and that's what
back.
I'm saying. Yeah. Like it's very, this movie is very instructive in finding ways to visualize goals while the model scene is over explaining the other things need nothing to be said. So, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's so a nice tight package.
Yeah. Oh man, it's clean.
So clean. Do we really cover all is lost?
I feel like we did.
Oh, that no, that's the
we
thing.
Didn't. Yeah.
So that's the thing. I don't know what the all is lost. I've analyzed this movie over the years, stared at it, thought about it. And I'm not exactly sure what the all is lost moment is.
If you had
is.
To guess.
So let me describe the all is lost
moment.
Yeah,
go for
yeah,
it.
Do that first.
I did
yeah.
it in the last episode, yeah. which was 10 minutes ago. But, so all is lost.
Don't give our secrets up.
That is the label All is Lost is a Blake Snyder label. You'll see it in lots of books and theories, but it's the point in the movie. It's usually about the 75% mark where the worst possible thing happens. Something goes wrong in a horrible way, and it usually has a whiff of death is what he calls it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times a character dies there. Somebody important to them will be kidnapped. They'll lose the in a romance movie. They might break up there. That might be the big breakup where they have a blow up. And then the immediate scene that follows it is the dark night of the soul. It's often when they kind of go into this, you know, the almost like self-doubt state, or they have this moment where they have to reflect or feel bad about themselves or something before new information comes, and then we go to act three. So in this movie, the reason I always have trouble with it is because if it is, there is an all is lost moment. And I have a couple theories of possibilities. I don't know what the dark night of the soul, it doesn't have to take the time for the dark night of the soul
yeah.
to follow. And that's usually the purpose of the all is lost, is kind of to trigger that
yeah.
and then get over that and go to the finale. This movie doesn't really take the time to do that as much. It's paced weird. And there's a couple of key moments.
Yeah.
So here are my theories, and I'll let you think about them.
I've already got two I can think of, but
so,
I want to hear yours.
So one is, honestly, when it starts to go bad in the car, like to me, that feels like the type of thing that's a dark night of the soul. But all is lost. But there really is no dark night of the soul.
That would be my first answer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But honestly, yeah. that feels to me like the worst thing could happen. It
mm-hmm.
feels like the plan is screwed.
Yeah.
Because well,
that's the goal.
It's the only
His
thing left. One
is,
chance. And
yeah.
Yeah. Like,
right.
Is resting on this.
Right.
Yeah.
So and he's locked in the trunk. I think the all is lost is locked in the trunk.
I've heard. So that's the one I pick. Right.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And you
but
could
you're
almost
asking about the dark night of the soul.
Yeah,
part of it.
Yeah. So then it's I guess it's him playing the music or something. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind
because
of this weird.
Like I did it and it still isn't working. I'm disappearing. No,
you're right. No, I'm
yeah.
saying yeah. No, I'm agreeing with you. Yeah.
I think I've heard it argued, and this is the one that never made sense. I think there's a video online. I remember I used to show videos of Save the Cat to my students. They analyze them with clips of the movies, so they're more fun to, you know.
More fun. Yeah, yeah.
And I remember there was one I used to like cringe every time I saw it.
No.
But what it was it said the All Is Lost was like Doc Brown getting the note from Marty or
Jesus.
Something. Yeah, like and it, I was like, how could that possibly
no.
be all is lost? That's
maybe
the one.
For...
That's the one problem with using
I'd
video
say,
samples on the internet.
I'd almost like them more to even say like it was Marty writing the note.
Yeah.
That was dark because that's yeah. like one of the darkest moments for Marty as a character, where he doesn't have hope that it'll actually work.
It's got to be locked in the trunk because and like you said, things going wrong at the car because the whole existence.
The execution of that though doesn't feel like that.
I get
you know,
what you're
at all.
It doesn't line
yeah.
up with the
it's
way
it's played for laughs.
Him locked in the trunk.
Yeah,
but it's intercut with a scene that's not played for laughs
true,
at all.
Right, true.
The darkest scene in the movie. So like with
even
like
Biff's
Biff
not
is gonna,
funny anymore.
Yeah,
no,
Biff
yeah.
is gonna
no.
Yeah. So like
yes.
I think you're right.
It's weird because in most
but it's not clear.
It's not clean
clear.
Like
yeah.
everything else
everything
is.
Else
yeah.
And
yeah.
it's okay. It doesn't
have to be.
Doesn't take away from the movie then.
No,
it's
not at all.
No, not at
no,
all.
No, no.
I love yeah. it's one of my favorite movies. So it's just interesting that
yeah.
it's the one where most movies do have clear all is lost. That's
yeah.
the one thing that's almost rock solid in most
yeah.
movies.
And
it's very few movies that don't have a clear all is lost.
Yeah.
And you know what's interesting to your point?
Break-intos, other things.
Usually with the Dark Night of the Soul, you get the confessional.
Yes.
And this scene, this movie doesn't have a confessional.
And it might be because he does an art.
So people
that's
know.
Where the character admits their flaws.
They're like, I should have never done this.
Like, yeah. And that they accept responsibility for John McClane the way they
had
behaved.
never done this.
Everybody would have lived on the roof. God. Please listen to our Running Die Hard episode. Oh man! God!
So Jamie really is gonna bring that into every episode. We're just gonna be waiting for it. So it's interesting. There's no confessional.
And maybe because he doesn't really arc. Yeah. It kind of goes to that. Right?
Yeah.
Because it would almost
like skips past that.
You could almost look at what is his father's all his lost moment.
Yeah.
Does he have an all his lost moment? Does he recover?
And when his arm is being twisted by Biff?
Yeah, I think it happens fast. It's all fast.
It's all when Biff has the upper hand and then he gets the courage, right?
Yeah.
And B story.
I feel like writing the note comes somewhere in there. I don't know why.
True.
The writing the note to me feels like it has something to do with what you're saying.
Yeah. Because usually that is where mentors go to die as the all is lost. So I'm sure they saw that and this is a whiff of death. It's nobody wants Doc Brown to die. This is really sad. This must be the all is lost, but it doesn't really function that way.
Yeah, you're
but
right.
Again, the car scene, like here, I'm not saying this would be a better movie at all, but the way a typical all is lost would work is like, let's say Marty got locked in the trunk and then Biff ran off with
Lorraine.
And then the third act was, I got to save, you know, and then he figures out where they are after he talks to George and they go off. And
Where'd they go?
Yeah. Maybe something like that.
Or are you saying like he'd have to choose between going back and saving his?
It could be.
Because he doesn't really need to make that choice in the movie.
No, not at all. Yeah.
It just works out.
Or he feels like he needs to make that choice, but then a third option presents itself. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'm going to do it. And that's act three.
Yeah.
That's how a typical movie would.
Biff can shoot force lightning. And then
Right. Anyway, the All Is Lost is one that's always made me think about this movie. I'm not sure that has a perfect example of one. And that's why, like, if I was presenting a Blake Snyder beat sheet, I'm not sure that I'd choose this movie to present because of that
reason.
It wouldn't
I would have said
perfect.
The car. That's what I would have said.
Me too.
The trunk, that makes sense, though, too.
That's the one.
It's just the trunk execution to me doesn't...
Feels comedic before it hits the darkness.
Yeah, it doesn't feel right, whereas...
I got you.
Whereas, like, that moment, while it feels more mechanical,
no
pun intended... But it feels more mechanical, like execution wise. It just feels like, okay, now what? Like, there's nothing. You can't miss this. Like,
it's one shot. So it's
a
little different. Right. And that's what's interesting about this movie being so good and doing things a little different.
Sure. Works fine.
Yeah.
Works fine.
The one thing I wrote on here, which we do not need to go through if you really guys don't want to, I just wrote this movie has an awesome whiteboard for both time travel and for meeting your parents. Like, it just goes down the list.
And you got to imagine that, like we've talked about in the past, that initial whiteboard probably led to the things that go in part two and three.
Yes.
You know?
And if for anyone listening, what is a whiteboard, guys? It's an idea board for a premise, right?
It's basically a list of ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's what
we call it, our whiteboard is our idea making process based on the premise. Right.
You don't have to have a whiteboard though. You can
it's
basically like for this it would be like okay,
cards, an app on your phone.
Yeah. For this it would be like I want to make a movie where I meet my parents in the 50s,
in
high school.
Yeah.
What do I want to see? You write down everything that could possibly happen, you know?
Yep.
I get hit on by my mom.
And you just keep going.
Right. Yeah, right. I meet my uncles. I meet my family. Yeah.
Characters based on that question. Set pieces based on that question.
Right. I get to see how, you know, my neighborhood changed. Where the people were, where they were then, where they were now.
Yep.
Right, yeah, all that stuff. But I think the biggest thing we got left is the original draft versus the draft
so
that we know and love.
First, and I'm glad I didn't
even
have that one on my
list. And it's something we don't normally do.
Yeah,
really.
We like Jamie, like Bob, you said, we treat the final movie like the script.
Script, right.
But
and the draft I had was actually the 84 draft. So that was that was probably their shooting.
Pretty
draft.
Close.
Yeah, it was probably really close to the shooting.
So there's a woman named H.R. DaCosta. She has a great site called Scribe Meets World. And she had actually snippets from the script, which was awesome. I didn't take the snippets, but like from the 1981 draft.
Yeah.
And she was, I think it's very instructive to see where things started and where things ended and how like the power
so
of
different.
Rewriting so different. And
oh
Bob, you probably know all this.
I'm like, you wrote it down though, so I'm going to let you
see.
Go for it. Yeah.
And it's just goes to show you, they wrote this script for 4 years minimum. maybe longer than we, I don't know the full gestation period, but at least 4 years. This draft is 1981 that I'm quoting.
There's no way this could have the great ticking clocks in it.
It's got, I'm only doing like a half dozen.
Okay.
Her article, she has two articles and it's like 20 something things that are different and like the choices made and why they made them and what they say about storytelling. Yeah. So the opening scene, do you know this, Bob?
Go ahead.
The original opening scene. The original opening scene was Marty in his house making VHS bootlegs of movies. And so he's like kind of a thief in that time, like people, it's become normalized now, but it wasn't normalized.
He's a pirate.
He's a pirate.
He's a pirate.
And then Doc is trying to harness the power of the sun and has like a page long monologue about the future of solar power. So, I mean, you think about the contrast in now, like almost nothing is said, and like the visual. I mean, the opening scene is
Now Doc has a reveal. Himself, he's like a twist in the beginning act. You know, it's like totally different.
Well, just that opening page is like so interesting and weird and awesome. Yeah. Like the clocks, the plutonium on the TV, the skateboard rolling in, all that shit is.
It's like, kind of like if they made a movie. You know how they made Mac and Me because of ET? That draft is the Mac and Me of Back to the Future. You know what I mean? That's what it is. Yeah.
Man.
weird comparisons.
The time machine introduction. I'm sure you know this one, Bob. It's inside Doc's house.
Yep.
And it's an old furnace and hot water heater cobbled together, which is like very visually uninteresting. Mm-hmm. And it shoots red beams of light at his monkey Sherman.
Yeah, Einstein's a monkey.
Yeah.
And named Sherman, right.
And it doesn't move.
No.
It just sits still like in a closet, like in his lab. It's even hidden in a closet, and it's introduced with just a red beam of light.
It's more like a Star Trek teleporter type of a deal.
Think about the difference in those things and how just even making it mobile changes like the
everything. Yeah.
The end of Act 1, the 1981 version... Doc is putting the instructions into the water heater, which is just crazy to say, to take Einstein or
Sherman
the monkey
yeah.
back again, because that same scene exists with the 1 minute. Hey, look, Sherman went back.
Yeah.
And the FBI comes in, not the Libyans. Mm-hmm. And the FBI shoots.
That part I remember. Yeah.
And the FBI shoots Doc. It's all in his house, though. Inside, and then
it's
Marty.
Just so much darker. The FBI shooting him for some reason feels way darker.
It's darker. It's not dynamic. It's like way less interesting.
It's weird what a stroke of genius the DeLorean was.
Changes it
all.
Well,
because it makes it cool too.
It makes it cool,
fun.
The driving to get there, all that stuff, and it's not an obvious thing. Like it's not something you'd whiteboard necessarily.
Right.
You said I'm making a time travel movie. You wouldn't come up with DeLorean.
You can see how they got. That draft, they're probably thinking of the time machine.
Sure.
The movie, the time machine.
Yes.
It's a stationary thing that you sit in.
What's our version of
it? And let's not forget, the first commercials for this movie had the time machine in them.
That's
from
a good
the time
point.
Machine. And Marty was sitting here. Yeah.
And the inspiration for this, is, again, it was more about when I meet my parents, would I like them? So they're not worried about
the interpersonal drama.
They were trying to get the other stuff
first. Not the cinematic.
Yeah.
Tech stuff.
It could have been a cardboard box.
Right.
It wouldn't, you know.
But the problem
is, you watch those scenes
that,
and you're like, that scene is so well directed of all the car movements and stuff and
the
shots.
Like, how it did not
like,
start
how did that,
like
yeah.
that.
Like, how
it
did you not
It wasn't born
do
from
that?
That?
Yeah. It's so
it
cool.
It feels like that's the idea.
Yeah, right.
Right?
I almost want to know how they came up with that. Like, what was it?
The notes.
I'm sure Bob Gale
I want to hear the notes. Who made the notes? Like, was it Bob Gale to Bob Zemeckis or Bob Zemeckis to Bob Gale? Was it like some? I want to know. Yeah, I'm fascinated by that choice.
Like how they come about?
Yeah, how they decided on the DeLorean. So yeah, the end of Act One is.
By the way, sorry to interrupt.
No, you're good.
The one thing I remember reading about this was, and this you might be hitting this, is I think this was on Wikipedia, so it could be totally false. That Spielberg kind of stole the whole nuke the fridge concept from this.
Yeah, I'll that's get there. I'm gonna go in.
I've read that. I don't know
order.
If I believe
it is. It's in the original script. Yes.
No, I'm saying that Spielberg stole.
Oh.
It.
Oh, well,
I don't know if I believe that part.
Not literally stole, but inspired by.
Yeah, that there is a nuke the fridge type scene.
Yes.
In this.
So okay, we'll get there. That's.
I just don't believe Spielberg would.
No,
he wasn't
not
thinking
steal.
That.
It we're saying borrowed or inspired by. Yeah, Jamie. It's on the end. It's the last one. Lorraine and George's relationship in the original draft. There was no motivation given for why she connects with him and falls in love with him. That backstory about George almost getting hit by a car and her having to nurse him to help didn't exist. So it was just because. And to me, that's like a huge.
So now, how did Marty interfere with that?
I don't know those details, I know that line.
I've never heard that before.
The Nightingale effect, where a nurse falls in love with their patient, was specifically chosen for Doc to say it because it's a scientific phenomenon, and that was like the genesis of it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I mean, that's huge.
That's insanely
huge.
What did they do to make Marty interfere with it?
I don't know.
Did they just explain it with the butterfly effect,
action
of being
there? Obviously.
Yeah. The script. I've seen the script out there.
The 81 one. The 81 draft.
I've seen it.
Marty's urgency. The early drafts had no photo, so all the stakes were the same.
Disappearing, maybe?
I don't know, but the photo was a late addition, which is, you think, how can I visualize the countdown? I need something else. That photo.
So I didn't know these.
And this is the last one, is Jamie, the climax. In the first draft, they had to leave town and go to some other desert base location.
Nevada.
They never set it up. They had to go to this whole new place with all these new people and all these new things, and they had to use the power of an atomic bomb to get back to the future.
Do you know that could put, I could see how that's a first draft thought, because they're dealing with the 50s here.
Right.
So there's some sort of atomic scare thing going on.
Yeah.
Sci-fi movies in the 50s.
We could use that.
Yeah. It seems
and
like
also,
it makes
sense. How do we get the power? And then, the problem solving.
Did they use that in Howard
bolt.
The Duck?
It's almost like
the bad guy Howard the Duck.
It's almost like that line that Marty and Doc are debating together about, there's only one thing that could give us this much power to get back to the future is an atomic bomb. Yeah. And then they go, wait, what if it was a lightning bolt? The problem solving to get to these places.
Something that can only happen one time.
One time.
Yeah.
Timely, right? Timely fashion.
How do they know it? Right.
I stumbled upon this article and I was so happy because I think it's very informative and it's very interesting and
So give the plug to that article again.
H.R. DaCosta, Scribe Meets World, and she has great books too. Yeah.
So that's actually a lesson on rewrites right there.
Mm-hmm.
The power of rewriting.
Yeah, it didn't start like a masterpiece at all.
So get your vomit draft out.
Yeah, man.
And then change your
monkey
to a dog.
4 years minimum. I don't know the exact date, but that date is 4 years from the eventual script they use. So,
Yeah, I know it started in 1980,
So before Romancing the Stone then?
I think so.
That's amazing.
Yeah, much, much before.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah. And before that, time travel movies were not prevalent, right? There's The Time Machine, and then
people hadn't tapped into the fun factor of it.
When was Star Trek IV?
That was
late 80s. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that had to be after it, because that was kind of playing off of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, this movie's also the reason Bill and Ted didn't have a van. It's kind of funny because Bill and Ted originally had the van, and then they went to something more stationary.
That's so interesting. You wonder if they knew about each other, if the scripts both
I think
were
Bill
out
and Ted
there.
Was reacting to Back to the Future success.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yeah, because the original draft was their actual party van turned into a.
That works so well, man.
Yeah.
The
it's just funny that it reversed itself.
Yeah, that's so weird. The phone booth is iconic, but the party van fits them so.
Right.
I think one of my favorite shows as a kid was Voyagers. Did you ever see Voyagers?
Never did.
No.
Oh, it was my favorite show.
It was a time travel show?
It was a time travel show about a guy named Phineas Bogg and a kid, and they would go around and they'd fix. It was a little like
Phineas Bogg.
Phineas Bogg was the guy's name. He was kind of this swashbuckling dude. He was like this good-looking guy with a deep voice. And there was a little kid that was kind of like a little kid Shia LaBeouf kind of kid.
Okay.
And they used to go around and fix problems in history. So they, every week they'd go to a different historical
like
time piece.
Quantum Leap did.
Like Quantum Leap. It was very similar
or
to Quantum
Sliders,
Leap.
Maybe.
But more but more more, I don't know, pulpy or something.
Okay.
You know, it was like let's fix you know, Genghis Khan didn't I don't know if
it would
be that.
How about that?
But you know, Abraham Lincoln didn't do this. So we gotta
Was that before this?
It was before that.
Ah. Yeah.
No, one of the first time travel movies I can think of that I saw as a kid was Time Bandits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was mine.
Yeah.
Is that before Back to the Future?
I think it's
I'm
earlier.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Like, I'll look it up, but I think that was early earlier. 80s. Like
the history of time travel movies.
Yeah, jeez. Yeah.
Well, is there anything? Well, I mean.
I think we've hit on
I think
everything.
We hit everything we wanted to.
Yeah.
Because Back to the Future is such a perfect movie to talk about.
Yeah, Time Bandits, 1981.
Mm, oh, awesome.
There you go.
So what do we learn from Back to the Future, guys?
I learned that maybe Marty does have an arc.
Yeah, I thought I was going to say that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The All Is Lost is something I've confirmed with you. You know, I still don't believe it has a true All Is Lost. And that's interesting.
That.
And it works just fine.
Yeah.
I
guess what I was trying to say earlier was
maybe
like
not missing, but
the emotion that comes from the All Is Lost, I feel like it's supplanted by the writing of the letter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like while that might not count, I feel like that's the moment in the movie that would fill in that spot with the emotional gravity.
Does that
make sense?
I think you hit a key point, the problems with some of these writing gurus and gurus in general.
Me?
Is what you just said. And it's hard to put into words, but sometimes you don't have to hit the beats.
Absolutely.
But you have to understand the emotions of why it goes there. And if you can hit that, you're okay.
Without the beat making sense. Yeah.
That's why like some movies don't really have inciting incidents or something, or they come late, but they know why it needs to be
you
there.
You still
and
enjoy
it. They work around it.
Yeah.
You know? There's something else there that's taking its place.
And like, then you can see how like masters kind of play with it, like Coen Brothers,
all the time.
They all kind of play with
Coen Brothers all the time.
Yeah, they play with that stuff. They don't have the page 25, right?
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah,
it's
Well, I did. I mean, that the All Is Lost thing is something that I did not ever think about with Back to the Future. Marty's got an arc. All right, guys. We did it.
Thank you for listening. 50.
Thank you for listening up until now. Like,
yeah,
if you have.
If you've been listening to us for 50 plus hours.
Or even just 1 hour. Yeah.
Just one.
Thank you.
It's really cool.
Yeah. This has been a fun thing.
Yeah.
So
bring a friend.
Yeah.
Invite a friend.
Yeah. We never do that.
Bring a friend episode.
Well, share the freaking thing. You know, if you can't, do us a favor.
I think Jamie finally did a real legit long plug, and it's a long time coming.
Yeah.
Like your plugs are usually like maybe like 5 seconds. That was a good plug.
Okay.
50 episodes. It's about I have been told that I don't tell people that like what my site is. Like I say, I'm script consultant. Hey,
this episode 50. Do it.
Script Butcher. www.scriptbutcher.com. I am usually booked about 90 days in advance, but I'm fortunate of that. But yeah, if you want notes on your script, hell, it's episode 50. Why not do the plug?
And, you know, subscribe to Thunder Grunt on your favorite podcast app. This is one show. We've got 4 active shows. I'm on 2 of them. They're all my friends. I do this because I want my friends to have a place to do this stuff. Please subscribe.
I'm grateful, Bob.
So,
this started out of a Facebook
conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I like, please like support us, follow us on the Thunder Grunt, get your friends to do it. And if you have any questions, find us on Twitter or email us at
writersblockbusterspodcast@gmail.com.
Right. And buy Jamie's book.
This
Nomad.
Is Plug Central.
Nomad.
I love it.
Well,
everybody turned it off 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, they did.
Plug away. Say whatever you want.
Say whatever you want. Yeah. Nomad, though, is your book. And buy that.
Nomad on Audible.
Hell yeah.
Follow my YouTube channel, youtube.com/thundergrunt. And if you see us on the street, give us a hug.
Yeah.
Don't do that, actually. At all.
But thank you so much for listening.
Thank you. And thank you guys for doing it too.
Thank you, Bob.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jimmy.
You've just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring 2 professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.